Thank you. I love the little dramatization and the change in intonations. It's great. I love it. I almost wanted to start acting it out. It was great. So we've become a society where we use a lot of expressions and imagery and symbolism, and one of the things that we use is oftentimes colors. We use a lot of colors to describe things, and I know when I was a little kid, I don't know why, I loved colors. Maybe it's because the only thing I could actually see, so I loved them. I don't know, but I loved colors, and so anytime there's these expressions that involve colors or anything, it really kind of draws my attention, and I listen, and so I think of colors and all the ways it symbolizes different things, and one of the things that colors often symbolize is emotions. So when somebody says, "I'm blue," it means that they're what? They're sad. When somebody says, "Man, I am just seeing red," it means that they're angry. If somebody is yellow, if someone is yellow, yellow-bellied, what does that mean that they are? Yeah, they're scared. They're cowardly. And if somebody is green, it means that they are green with
envy.
And so as we've been doing this series on emotional support, looking at all of the different emotions that we experience and understanding that we cannot necessarily be subject to those emotions, but we need to instead submit them before God and deal with them and feel them in a way that's honoring and pleasing to Him. And so we've been looking at various emotions. We looked at anger. Last week we looked at anxiety and stress. And so this week we are going to look at what green often symbolizes, which is envy, or envy and jealousy. And so that is the emotion we're going to look at today. We're going to sort of understand a bit of a biblical perspective of envy, of jealousy, and see scripturally what it means and what we should be doing with it, how we should be handling it, and how it would be appropriate. So we're going to start off with just sort of looking at what is envy. What is envy? Well, this is a little bit different than some of the other things, or we could have done it with those other things, but we didn't. But envy is one of those where there is a lot involved in the emotion or in the feeling of envy. And so because there's a lot involved, there's various nuances to envy. And so I'm going to sort of look at what envy is and by looking at its nuances. I'm going to look at sort of what envy is by looking at the umbrella of terms and the umbrella of emotions and the umbrella of feelings that envy sort of covers. And so envy is more than just envy. There's more involved in it. And so we're going to look at several different aspects or terminology under the umbrella of envy. And so this makes sense that the first one under envy would be the word envy. Duh, right? Yeah. So envy. Like we said, the word envy in a sense covers all of these various terms, covers all of these sorts of things. But specifically what envy means is envy means to be painfully aware and resentful towards an advantage that someone else has. It's to be painfully aware and resentful towards an advantage that somebody else has. Now, I want to be very clear in saying this doesn't necessarily mean that you want that advantage or you want what that person has. It just means that you recognize that somebody has an advantage in their life. You recognize it. You see that advantage and you're aware of it, and yet you've become resentful towards it or bitter towards it. You've become bitter or resentful towards it. And so essentially, this is kind of what envy means. It means to look and to see that somebody has an advantage in their life. Something good is happening to them. They have some kind of a blessing, and yet we are not just aware of it, but we are bitter and resentful about it. Because they are experiencing an advantage that we are not experiencing. And so envy oftentimes happens in two major ways. The first, we oftentimes envy people that we are most similar to. We oftentimes envy people that we are the most similar to. People that we have a lot in common with. People that we can relate to. People that we identify with. By and large, people aren't going to be jealous over somebody that they have absolutely nothing in common with. They're not going to be jealous that somebody just gave a homeless person a free hot chocolate. You're not going to be jealous of that homeless person. You have nothing in common with them. You have nothing similar to them. We're often not jealous of people that we look up to. So oftentimes even we tend to be jealous of people more in our own age. Because if we look at people that are older than us, we respect them. We know they're wise. They teach us. And so we look up to them. And so we're not envious of them. But people maybe our own age, we are envious of. We're envious more of people that are in our own sort of socioeconomic status. We're envious of people who have certain families that we don't have, but we recognize that family relation or that family identification or connection. And so we oftentimes envy people that we are most similar to. Because when we're most similar to them, their advantage is going to stand out a lot more. Because we know what they're going through. We can identify with them. Our lives in many ways are very similar to theirs. So when they have an advantage, we take notice. The second sort of trend is we tend to be envious regarding the areas that we value the most. We tend to be envious over the areas that we value the most. So the question is what in your life do you value? What do you value? Because whatever you value is the area that envy is most likely to creep up in. So an example is if you value your work and you value being successful, then when you see somebody else being successful, especially in your same field of work, when you see somebody else being successful, if that's what you value, then you're going to start to become envious of that person because you're going to see their advantage, you're going to see their success, and you're going to start to become bitter and resentful because you value it and they are benefiting in a way through something that you value. If you value material possessions, then you're going to most likely be envious regarding other people's possessions. If you value all the toys, all the electronic doodads, all of the fancy cars, the nice things of life, the big houses, if you value all of those physical possessions, then chances are you're going to be envious when people like you have something newer and better than you do. You're going to be envious. You're going to resent it. And so envy is the painful awareness and resentment of an advantage that somebody has over you. So a great biblical illustration of this, a wonderful example of this, is Joseph and his brothers in Genesis chapter 37. If you, in your devotions this week or whatever, if you want to read this chapter, you'll see it says here that because Joseph was born to Jacob's favorite wife, and because Joseph was born later in Jacob's life, when he was older when Joseph was born, because of that, Jacob loved Joseph very much. In fact, he showed favoritism towards Joseph. so much so that he lavished gifts upon Joseph and would give him a robe of many colors and all of those sorts of things. And the brothers noticed this. The brothers saw this. The brothers saw how the father showed favoritism to their brother Joseph. And it says not only were they jealous of Joseph, but it says they hated him. They hated him. They saw the advantage. They saw that that Joseph had more of their father's love than they did. They saw that and they became bitter and resentful. And they hated him for it. Not to mention his prophetic gifts that God had given him with dreams and interpreting dreams. This made the brothers even more jealous that he had this gift, and ultimately it led to them wanting to kill him, but instead selling him into slavery. That is what their envy did. They saw the advantages that Joseph had, and they were bitter and resentful about it. Sort of a modern day illustration comes, it's not really a modern day illustration, but it's more of a modern story. And it comes from a Jewish parable. There was a farmer, and one night, late at night, he was laying in bed, and an angel of the Lord appeared to the farmer. And the angel of the Lord says, "Look, you have found favor in Yahweh. You have found favor in him. And because of that, God says he will grant you any three requests." So you can ask for any three things because you are faithful to him. You are a descendant of Abraham. You have found favor in him. And therefore, the three things that you request, the Lord will grant you. And the angel went away, and the farmer was so excited, he woke up his wife next to him, and he woke her up, and he says, guess what, an angel of the Lord appeared to me, and he says, I get three wishes. And you can imagine the look his wife gave him. Like, that was a dream, honey, go back to sleep. He says, no, it's real, it's true. And so the wife says, well, let's test it out, let's try it, let's make a request right now. And so the farmer goes, and he prays, and he says, you know what, God, I just pray that you will bless me by giving me a herd of 1,000 cattle. And this way, it will break the cycle of poverty that my family and ourselves have experienced for generations. So give us this herd of 1,000 cattle. And as soon as he got done praying, they heard all of these animal sounds. And so they got up and they looked out the window and they saw all of this cattle, this magnificent, beautiful, healthy cattle sitting around the house. And he says, that's wonderful. And he was so happy. But he was happy because he forgot one thing that the angel told him. He said, God will grant you three requests, any three requests that you want. He says, but this is your warning. Know that whatever you ask for, your neighbor will get twice as much. So the man goes and he's all excited. He's got 1,000 cattle on. It's great. And he's starting to make plans as to all the money that it's going to bring and all the affluence. He's trying to be practical and he's taking care of the animals. And he's so happy. He's on cloud nine. And then 3 days later, he happens to be on a hill where he's looking to build a big barn for all of his cattle. And he overlooks and he sees his neighbor's property. And what does he see? 2,000 beautiful animals. 2,000 magnificent cattle. All of a sudden, he becomes enraged. He becomes so jealous. He gets so angry. And he storms down to his house, and he's in such a bad mood. And he's so angry that now his neighbor has twice as many cattle as him, which means he's going to have twice as much wealth. And he is so angry and so bitter. And all of a sudden, that night, as he's laying there with this really angry, jealous heart, he remembers, wait a minute, the angel says, I have three requests. So let me give another request. And so he prays, he says, Lord God, I would love to have an heir to all of this that you have blessed me with now. I would love to have a child, someone who can carry on our name, our legacy. Would love to have a child. But it wasn't long before his wife announced to him that she was carrying the farmer's son or daughter. So as the months went by, he was on cloud nine, so happy, taking care of his animals, knowing that, man, he's going to have a child that he can pass all of this on to, and this child's going to be set, and he's going to have this legacy, and it's awesome, on cloud nine. And then the wife gave birth to a son, and the next day was the Sabbath, so he went to the synagogue, and he started to talk out and have a testimony. He goes, "The Lord God is good. I prayed for a son, and I got a son. I prayed for an heir, and I have an heir. He was born last night. God is so good." Well, just as he sat down, his neighbor stood up and said, "Yes, the Lord is good, and he has truly blessed this community because my wife just gave birth to twins last night." Well, this made the farmer extremely angry, and his mind started to go into a really dark place, and he became so envious and so bitter and so jealous of his neighbor that he went home, and in this dark place, he laid down in bed, and he goes, "All right, God, I have my third and final request. I ask that you gouge out my right eye." And the angel of the Lord appeared to him yet again, and he goes, "Descendant of Abraham, why would you ask for such a dark, twisted thing?" And he says, "Because I am willing to lose half of my sight with the knowledge of knowing that my neighbor will never see all of his blessings ever again. I am content with that. I am happy with that." And the angel of the Lord said to him, "The Lord will not grant this request, not because he is not a man of his word, but because it is not good or healthy." And he said to the farmer, "You have not only ruined yourself and broken your own heart and spirit, but you have broken the very heart of God as well." And this is what envy is, people. It starts off small. And it grows and it grows and it grows. And we see someone else's success. We see someone else's family. We see that somebody else is dating someone or married to someone. Or we see that this person has a brand new car and our car is falling apart. And it starts off small, but it grows and it grows and it grows. And when it grows, our bitterness grows. Our resentment grows. And our hearts grow darker and angrier and more envious of the advantage that the other person has. And the result turns out to be destruction. The result turns out to be destruction. James chapter 3, verse 16 says, "Whenever you have envy," I'm sorry, it's Proverbs, sorry. Proverbs 14:30 says, "Whenever you have envy, there your soul will rot." Envy will bring your soul to a place where it is rotten, where it is rotting. Envy brings destruction. It brings damaged relationships. When you've become envious of somebody, oftentimes you start to act out on that envy and treat that person poorly and angrily, and that gets in the way. We get damaged relationships. Other people start to suffer from the consequences of our enviness. It starts to affect our own health. It starts to affect our own mental status, our peace of mind. And so the result of envy is destruction. But what is next? The next is covetousness. Covetousness. Not only do we have envy, where we have this painful awareness and resentment of an advantage that somebody else has over us, but then we often develop covetousness, which is the actual wanting of that advantage for ourselves. So it's the physical yearning, it's the physical desire, it's that urge to have that very advantage. So you can be envious of somebody, not necessarily want what they have, just bitter that they're succeeding. But covetousness is, no, 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 I want what you have. I see your advantage. I'm resentful and bitter about it, but now I want it. So since you are achieving all of this great success at work, I want your success. You know what, man, my sister, man, oh, she just had another baby. Now my parents are telling us, when are you going to give us grandkids? And so now, man, I want her advantage. I want the kids that she has, so then that way my parents would leave me alone. We say, you know what, man, I work really hard. I work hard for every dollar I have, and it doesn't seem to go as far as it could. And I'm still struggling financially, and yet this person who makes about the same amount of money as me, man, they just bought a new car. How can they afford such a thing? I want a new car. I want their car. I want that advantage for myself. I work just as hard as they do, and therefore I want what they have. So we have this covetousness where that's even one of the Ten Commandments. Number 10 is you should not covet your neighbor's wife. You shouldn't see that, oh man, my neighbor, oh yeah. Oh, my neighbor's wife, man, she's so much prettier than mine. Oh, I wish I had that little trophy wife for myself. She's so pretty. I want her instead of mine. Do not covet anything of your neighbor. Do not want what they have. Do not covet their advantage, is what that commandment says. And a great example of this is Cain and Abel from Genesis chapter 4. Here they went and they presented sacrifices to God in respect to their own sort of fields of work. And yet God saw Abel's sacrifice to be worthy. He enjoyed Abel's sacrifice. He found it acceptable. But he did not find Cain's sacrifice to be acceptable. So he blessed Abel and not Cain. And therefore Cain became very envious and he became very covetous because his brother got the blessing from God and he didn't. And what happened? Cain killed Abel. Because he wanted what Abel had. He wanted that blessing. There was a couple men in a hospital. This is many years ago before, you know, hospitals started running their policies a little bit different. And both of these men were very sick, probably nearing the end of their lives. And so the hospital put them in a very small room together. And they weren't allowed to have a lot of visitors, and they weren't allowed to have a lot of commotion. It was just them. And so because of this, they were in this small room where there was just the two beds, two sort of tables on the side, a door, and a window. And so they had to lay pretty still, but the one man who was by the window as a part of his treatment to drain the fluids in his lungs, they would sit him up for an hour a day. And these men got to know each other very well. And they didn't have a whole lot to do. They couldn't have a lot of visitors. And so they would just talk to each other and they told each other about their families, their wives, their children, their former jobs, their hobbies. They would just tell them all the kinds of things. And that particular hour became very special to them because when that man was propped up for the hour, he used to look out the window and he used to describe to the other man what he would see. And so he would go and he would look and he would say, oh yes, there's a park across the street. And there's children that are playing in the park. And there's all of these beautiful young girls in all of these beautiful sundresses and it just looks so pretty. And this one's walking a dog and the dog is chasing its tail. It's really funny. It's really cute. And especially the man that wasn't by the window, really, he couldn't wait for this hour because it was more entertainment than he had the whole rest of the day. He just could not wait. And then one day the man was propped up and he says, oh my goodness, there's a parade going on out here. There's a marching band going by and some floats and oh, it's such a wonderful parade. And in that moment, the man laid there and he says, wait a minute, why does he get to be by the window and I don't? He's just as sick as me. I'm just as sick as him. Why does he get to look out the window? That's not right. I should be able to look out the window too. I should get a turn. I want the window. And he tried to squash this feeling. But every day as that time approached, that feeling of envy and wanting to be by that window, it just grew and grew and grew, and he became quite angry. And one night, the man by the window started having some problems with breathing. He was coughing some more, gasping for air. And the man not by the window had his finger by the call button for the nurse. And he remembered the window and how much he wanted to be by the window. So he chose not to hit the button. And the man coughed and gasped for air until the noises stopped altogether. So what is the result of being covetous? Once again, it's destruction. It is destruction. It's damaged relationships. It's not having a peace of mind. It's affecting other people. It's destruction. James chapter 4, verses 2 and 3 says, "You want, but you do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain it, so there are fights and quarrels among you." You covet, you want, you can't have, you can't obtain what somebody else has. So the result is conflict. The result is arguing. The result can even be murder. They want what I have, and I can't have it, so it just causes nothing but conflict. Nothing but conflict. And so covetousness brings about destruction. Next, we have jealousy. Be like, wait, Pastor Chris, envy and jealousy, that's the same thing. They're synonyms. It all means the same thing. Actually, no, it does not. It does not mean the same thing. Classically, the term jealousy means an intolerance to rivalry. An intolerance to rivalry. Well, what does this mean, to be intolerant to rivalry? It means that you don't want anybody to become the same as you, or you don't want anybody to become superior to you. If you have an advantage yourself, you don't want anybody else to experience that advantage either. You don't want anybody to be the same or even greater. So if you have an advantage, you don't want anybody taking that advantage away. And just like all of the other emotions, jealousy and envy isn't all the time bad. God even is jealous. It says in Exodus chapter 20, verse 5, it says, "Look, don't worship these other gods, for I am a jealous God. You are to worship me and me alone, not these pagan gods, not the gods from these Canaanites. I am the one true God. Worship me and worship me alone. I am a jealous God. Don't bring those false gods, don't bring those pagan gods up to my level and worship them as you worship me, because they aren't at my level. I'm more powerful. I'm real. I'm the one true God. So don't bring them up to my level. I am a jealous God. You worship me." And therefore, sometimes jealousy is okay and it's healthy for us because, again, it's an emotion that God gave us and we are made in his likeness. And since he feels it, we feel it too. And so there are times that jealousy isn't necessarily a bad thing. Think about the person who is actively trying to steal your spouse away. Well, that jealousy isn't so bad. Think about when the teenagers are trying to bring your child away from Christ and towards some other religion. We get jealous because we, just like God, we want our children, we want our loved ones to know God and to worship him, the one true God. And so there's this jealousy that takes place, and that's a good, that's a healthy jealousy. But the problem is oftentimes we direct that jealousy towards ourselves and towards selfish things, which makes it unhealthy and dangerous. Makes it unhealthy and dangerous. This was certainly the case for David and Saul. We see in 1 Samuel chapter 18, after David conquered and killed the giant Goliath, and he went out to war, and when he came back from his victories, the women of the town exclaimed, they said, "Look, Saul, he killed his thousands, but David, he killed his tens of thousands." And so Saul sees this and he goes, "Wait a minute, I'm the king. I'm the victorious one in Israel. Who is this guy trying to come up and surpass me? Look, they're singing a higher number. I'm only thousands and he's the tens of thousands. Wait a minute, this isn't good. He's trying to take my place as the top dog. He's trying to surpass me." So he became very jealous, so much so that he tried to kill David multiple times. Another modern example is a pastor was doing premarital counseling for a couple. And the pastor noticed that the soon-to-be groom had a bit of a jealous streak in him. And he started to bring it up in his premarital counseling. And the soon-to-be groom said, "You know what? You know, yeah, I know. I used to be really jealous. I used to have that kind of a problem." He goes, "But I've really taken care of it. I'm over it. I'm good. I don't have that problem anymore." So maybe against the pastor's best judgment, he married them anyway. Well, 4 months after they got married, they came back in for marital counseling this time. And when they came in, he said, "What's the problem?" And the wife stood up right away and she goes, "I'll tell you what the problem is. His jealousy is driving me crazy. On our honeymoon, he was looking at my phone to see who was texting me. He got into a verbal confrontation in an argument, a very heated argument with the guy on our honeymoon because he didn't like the way the guy looked at me." He goes, "And I can't," she goes, "I can't take it anymore." She goes, "You know how jealous he is? Do you know how much he doesn't want anybody to be around me or have any other kind of relationship with me other than him? Do you know how bad? What he does is he wakes up early in the morning and he writes down the mileage in my car. And when I come home from work, he goes out and he checks it again. And he says, if there's an extra mile or two, he asks me where I've been and why he didn't know about it." And he goes, "I just can't take it anymore." And they wound up being divorced 4 months later because he was jealous. And so once again, the result of jealousy is destruction. It's destruction. It damages relationships. When we start to think that we possess other people, well, this person, they're my friend, or this person, I'm dating this person, or this person, they're my brother, or this person, they're my sister, and therefore nobody else can be close with them other than me because I'm the spouse, or I'm the sibling, or I'm the friend. It damages the relationships because you start to smother that person and it becomes very unhealthy. James chapter 3, verse 16 says, "Wherever there is jealousy and selfish ambition, there you have disorder of all kinds." Wherever there is jealousy or selfish ambition, there is disorder of all kinds. It just leads to things being unhealthy and being destroyed and bitterness and damaged. And finally, we have competitiveness. Competitiveness. This is the need to win. This is the urge to be on top no matter what. This is an obsession with being the very best. Nobody can be like you are, and it stems from rivalry. If you don't want anybody to be the same or surpass you, then when you're jealous, you become very competitive. You want to be on top. You want to be number one. You want to be the best, and you become obsessed with it. Nobody can come anywhere near you. Parents do this all the time. They want to be their child's favorite parent, especially people that are going through a divorce. They don't want the kids to necessarily like going over to the other parent's house. They want to be happier at their house with them. So it becomes this competition. They want to be the best parent. Sibling rivalry. They want to be the best no matter what. This sibling wants to outdo the other siblings to have these bragging rights and say, yep, I was the best. I did it. I was mom and dad's favorite. I was the smartest. I was the most athletic. I was all of these things. We have these bragging rights and we want to be competitive. We want to be the most successful person. How many times do you go to a class reunion and it turns into just one big competition? Oh, well, I have this job and I make this much money. Oh, well, I have this job and I make this much money and I'm married and I have 4 kids. Well, I have 3 kids. Well, I have more kids than you. Yeah, but you spend more money than I do, so I have more money than you. It becomes this big competition. And guess what, ladies and gentlemen? A great example of this is the Pharisees with Jesus. Here were the Pharisees, the religious leaders of the day, those in the temple. And all of a sudden, Jesus came around and he started gathering all of these crowds to listen to him. And he started generating all of these disciples. And the Pharisees said, wait a minute, no, we are the religious authority. We are on top. We are the ones that God speaks to. Therefore, the people need to follow us. They need to be our disciples, not this guy. I don't know who this guy thinks he is, but we're the best. We're number one. And as a result of their jealousy, as a result of their envy, as a result of their competitiveness, they had Jesus killed and crucified on the cross. The very cross of our salvation was based upon envy and competition. Think about that. You know, we all know people that are competitive. As I'm going through this series with these various emotions, I'm coming up with all of these stories of my family, and I'm thinking to myself, man, my family's really messed up. Because our family, we have this favorite game. It's called Phase 10. If you've never played it, you should. It's awesome. But my family has some psychological issues when they play this game. For instance, whenever we play it, somebody is super competitive. And we like to tease each other. And if we know what the other person needs, we hold it up and be like, do you need this? Do you need this? And we just harass each other and have a good time. And when we want to skip somebody, we stick it on our forehead and we say, who's going to be next? You know, we have a good time with it. Well, not everybody enjoys this so well. In fact, my brother-in-law, who was here last week from Texas, he's a very competitive person. And whenever we play Phase 10 with him, it becomes nasty. So much so that one time when he was playing with my sister, he stabbed the chicken cordon bleu with his pen. Last week, we played it after church with my family. And he got so mad that he was skipped instead of me that he got up and he says, I am not playing this anymore. And he stormed off and shut the door. Why? Because he wasn't going to win and he wanted to be competitive. I think if you've ever been to the Gaming Grotto or even if you've been a part of the youth group or anything like that, I think you've seen how competitive Pastor Nathan used to be. He used to tackle people. It was violent. It was rough stuff right there. He was super competitive. And so we all experience this, but the problem is when you are so competitive and you always have to be on top, it also causes destruction and it causes damaged relationships and it causes turmoil and conflict. And so whenever we experience envy of any kind, if it's unhealthy, it always turns out to be destructive. And so what do we do? What is an appropriate way to handle envy? What is an appropriate way to handle it? Well, we can get a couple of tips from the parable that Danny so wonderfully read this morning. Here in the parable, Jesus tells a story of a landowner, and he goes out early in the morning when the workday began, probably around 6 a.m., and he goes and he brought the day laborers into to the field, and he says, look, I will pay you a denarius, a day's wage, essentially, when you work. And usually their work hours are from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., so you work the full 12 hours, you'll get the full day's pay, I'll give you what you deserve, I'll give you what is right, and all of that. So he brought them in, and he noticed there was a lot of work to be done. So he went back out at 9 o'clock, 3 hours later, and he went and he saw more people, and he goes, "Why aren't you working?" And they said, "Well, nobody hired us." So he goes, "Come on, I have work for you to do, and I'll pay you what is right." Once again, at about noon, he did the same thing, went out, got some more. And then several hours later, he did it one more time, went out and got some more. And so when the day's work was done at 6 p.m., when the day's work was done, the landowner went to pay them their wages for the day. And he goes to the ones that he hired last that had only been working for a short amount of time. And he gave them a denarius, a full day's pay for just a little bit of work. And so those who were hired earlier were thought, "Oh man, if he's given them a full day's pay, he's bound to give us even more because we were here even longer. We were here, we worked all day." But the landowner only gave everybody a denarius. And the people were saying, "Wait a minute, we worked longer. We were here since 6 a.m. We worked 12 hours. Why are you giving us the same amount of money as you gave the ones that just got here?" And the landowner says, "Look, I told you. When I hired you, I would give you a denarius. I would give you a day's pay. And that is what I gave you. I gave you what I promised. I gave you what was told, what you were told. So who were you to criticize me if I want to be generous and give just as much to other people?" And Jesus told this story in regards to faith, and he says, look, it doesn't necessarily matter when we come to faith in Jesus Christ. As long as we come to faith in Jesus Christ, we all receive the same reward of forgiveness, salvation, and eternal life. But this parable also has a really good meaning for us in this life in regards to jealousy and envy. So it teaches us three things. First, it teaches us to stop comparing, submit to God's sovereignty. Stop comparing and submit to God's sovereignty. The workers were just comparing themselves. "Hey, look, you know, wait a minute. They were here later and they got this much, and we were here earlier and we got the same amount. That's not right. Look what they got and look at what we got." They were so busy comparing themselves with other people. It was all about the other person. And when you look at the other person, they got jealous. They got envious. And we oftentimes do the same thing. How many times do we compare ourselves to other people? "Oh man, I wish I were as funny as him." Or, "Oh man, I wish I had that kind of a job and made more money. Oh man, you know, look at them. They're so beautiful." And all of these kinds of things. And, "Oh man, look at how wonderful their family is. How well the husband and wife get along and how well behaved the kids are. Look at all that. I mean, my kids are a terror and my spouse and I are fighting all the time. Look at that. And we compare ourselves to everybody else and we look at all of the blessings and all of the advantages that others have and we compare ourselves. We say, "They have it and I don't." And it says, stop comparing. The landowner told them, say, "Yeah, I gave them the same amount as you, but what I give them is none of your concern. As long as I gave you what I promised you, that is what you should be concerned with. Don't worry about what I gave them. Worry about yourself. Stop comparing. Stop looking at other people, because it will only bring about envy. It will only bring about jealousy and competitiveness, and it will only bring about destruction. Stop looking around at other people. Instead, we need to trust in God's sovereignty. Hey, the landowner said, "I gave you what I told you. And who cares if I gave them a little extra? It's my money. I can do with it what I want." And God says the same thing to us. Look, through faith in me, I've given you salvation. I've given you eternal life. Hey, look, you know, I've provided for your needs. You have food in your stomach. You have a roof over your head. You have friends. You have family. You have all of these things. I've given you all of this. So what if I give somebody else a little bit more? What's that to you? I'm God. I'm sovereign. I will do what I will do. This is what Hannah says in her song in 1 Samuel chapter 2. She says, look, you make some rich and you make some poor. You lift some up high and you bring some down low, because you are the almighty sovereign God, and God will give us what is good for us. We can't compare ourselves and say, well, man, this person's so much better at this, and this person's so much better in that. So what? God gave them that gift. God gave them that blessing. But God gave you your gifts and your blessings. And instead of looking at what you don't have and comparing, you should just say, you know what, God, I trust in you. I trust you know what you're doing. I trust that you will give me what is best for me and what is best for your kingdom. I look around. And I say, you know what? Man, what am I doing? I look at, like, my favorite pastor, Stephen Furtick. He's, like, the same age as me. He's the same age as me. And he's got a church of, like, 11,000 people. And he has all of these employees and all of these pastors doing all of these different things. And here, you know, it's just me. I do everything. And I start to compare myself, man, if I had all of those people and if I had all of those other pastors, man, imagine what kind of ministry we could do, man. That would be awesome. And I start to compare myself. And God says, look, don't worry about him. Worry about yourself. Make sure that you are leading your flock to the best of your ability, because I have entrusted them to you, and they are just as important as the 11,000 that Stephen Furtick pastors. And guess what? We compare. And you know what? More often than not, when we get what the other person has, it turns out to be a disappointment anyway. Going back to that hospital room, after his roommate passed away, after what seemed like a respectable amount of time, he asked the workers if he could be switched to the bed next to the window. They granted his request and they put him in the bed, and after they had left the room, he struggled and he tried and he propped himself up on one elbow and really struggled to do it, and he'd smile on his face and he goes to look out the window, and what does he see but a brick wall? When we compare ourselves with what others have, when we want what they have, oftentimes when we get it, it's not what it was cracked up to be, and we don't find it as satisfying as we thought it was anyway. We got to stop comparing ourselves with others and just start trusting in God's sovereignty, that he is going to give us what we want, what we need in his timing, in his way, and with what is right. So we need to stop comparing and we need to submit to his sovereignty. Next, we need to stop begrudging the success of others. Stop begrudging the success of others. And instead, we need to be secure in ourselves. We need to be secure in ourselves and know that it is all for God's glory. Instead of begrudging others and their success, we should be secure in ourselves and know that it is all for God's glory. It says in the parable that Danny read that all the workers were grumbling about the wages. They were grumbling. They were complaining. They were getting upset that the other people got as much money as they were. They were complaining that other people received blessings. They were complaining that other people received the fortune of this landowner. They were complaining. They were grumbling. And the word in Greek has a text that makes it known that it wasn't just they grumbled a little bit. It used what's called a continuous tense, which means it says they were grumbled and they kept grumbling. They kept complaining. They kept being negative and complaining and doing all of these kinds of things. They kept on grumbling about what this landowner did for the other workers. And the truth is we do it too. We look and we say, this person has this, this person has that, this person succeeds here, this person's so good at this, and we start to resent them and we start to begrudge their success. Why are they successful? I'm just as good. Why do they have, you know, that wife? You know, I'm just as lovable as that person. Why do they have that car? I work just as hard as they do. Why are they so funny? I think I'm pretty funny. Why are they so much at peace? Why do they have so much joy? Why do others like them so much? I'm just as likable. I really try to be at peace. I try to be full of joy. Why do they have so much more peace and joy than I do? And yet we start to get mad at it. We start to say, you know, but that's not right. It's not right. I should have that. I should have that joy. I should have that peace. I should have that car. And we begrudge it. We complain and we moan and we groan. We complain. And instead, we need to be secure in ourselves. It's awfully hard to be jealous of somebody else when you are secure in who you are and who God has made you to be. It is really hard to say, man, I wish I were like that person, or I wish I had that. When we say, you know what? God made me. He made me good in His sight. He placed me here. He gave me this blessing of life, this blessing of food, of breath. He's given me so many blessings, more than I even deserve. And God has made me to be the best that I can be. And therefore, because I am God's child, because I am His creation, and He made me how He wants me, I'm going to be secure, and I'm not going to worry about that other person. I'm not going to be mad that they have it better than me, because God loves me, and He made me to be me. But when we're so insecure, that's when all that jealousy takes place. I often think of my mother, who always talks about when she was a kid, she was in the band, and so she was picked on, and everyone made fun of her, and all of those sorts of things. And it really gave her this self-esteem problem, really made her insecure as to who she is. And so now, as an adult, she's allowed this insecurity to direct her life, and now she's become, in some ways, a very envious person, where if I call Dad, my father, twice in the week, and I call her once in the week, she makes a note of it. Wait a minute. You called your dad two times. You only called me once. What, you don't like me anymore? But that's because she's insecure in herself, and she portrays that on other people. But if we really know who God made us to be, and if we are really truly secure that God is guiding our lives and He is providing for us, if we truly know that and we are truly secure in who we are and what God has done for us, then we're not going to be nearly as envious or jealous. And in addition, we have to know that it's all for God's good. It's all for His glory anyway. Here's these workers, they're complaining, they're grumbling that these other workers got just as much money as they did. Instead of saying, you know what, that's good, I'm glad you gave them just as much money as me, because it was a lot of work, and when they came in and helped us, we got more done. Instead of looking at all of these things and saying, you know what, it wound up being beneficial, we only want it for ourselves. And so I look at somebody like Stephen Furtick, and I say, you know, again, man, you know, he has all these pastors, they can do all this stuff, they have 11,000 people, he's got all of these kinds of things. Instead, I should be saying, you know what, that's awesome. Instead of begrudging him, instead of being jealous or envious in any way, I should say, good for him. I'm happy for you. I'm happy that God's kingdom is being grown and being flourished because of him. And ultimately, it's all about God. It's all about growing His kingdom. It's not about me. So instead of being jealous or upset or complaining, I should be happy that he is so successful. God has given us all abilities. He's given us all gifts. He's given us all talents. And he's given them to us with different degrees. Some people, while there's multiple good teachers, some teachers are a little better than others. And guess what? God has given us that. But he says, guess what? You all have talents. You all have gifts. You all have these abilities. You all have these financial resources. You all have these family resources. You have all of these things. And instead of wanting other people's things for yourselves, think about how your blessings and how somebody else's blessings can be put together for my glory. But we don't think about God. We only think about ourselves. Man, I want to be a good teacher like this person. And instead of saying, I'm not a good teacher, but I'm a good servant, why don't I help you in your teaching and coming together for God's kingdom? So instead of begrudging, instead of complaining and moaning about what we don't have, maybe we should be secure in who God made us to be and look at all of these things as blessings and use them for God's glory and for His kingdom. And finally, we should stop striving. We should stop striving for worldly accolades. But we should do our best for God. Stop striving for worldly accolades, but do your best for God. Here's the workers are saying, hey, wait a minute. We were here first. We were here very early in the morning. Look at us. Recognize me. I did this. I did that. I want the recognition. I want the props for what I've did. I want it. Look at me. So reward me for all that I've done. Reward me for all the time I was here. Look at me. I want that recognition. I want that paycheck. I want those earthly, worldly accolades. And we do the same thing. We say, hey, you know, I did this for the church and I didn't even get a thank you. Or hey, I did this and nobody even recognized it. Or hey, I worked harder than this person and they got more compliments than I did. Or we start to compare, because a competition is just a part of our culture. You have sports and you have reality TV shows where people compete, and even churches compete against one another. Oh, well, this church is better than this church because of this. Or, oh yeah, this church is better for this and this church is better for that. And churches even compete with one another. You go to a pastor's conference and it turns into like a class reunion. Well, how many are in your church? Oh, how many small groups do you have? Oh, well, we have more than this. Oh, how many instruments does your praise band have? Oh, well, we do this and we even record CDs. So we must be better and more holy than you. We search for these worldly accolades and we say, yeah, more people come to my church. That means we're better. Recognize me. We say, hey, yes, you know, we have more of this, so that means we're better. Come to us. We're in constant competition with one another as people and as churches and as Christians. And God says, guess what? Don't look for those worldly accolades. Don't be worried about how many people are following you. Don't be worried about how many people recognize your good work. Don't be worried about all of these other things. He says, instead, do your best for God. Instead of saying, hey, I was here first, pay me more, we should say, you know what? I did my best, and that's good for God. Because Colossians chapter 3, verse 23 says, all of our work is to be done for the glory of God, no matter what it is. No matter what you are doing, no matter who you are, as long as you are doing your best and you're doing it to serve God, then that is what matters. You don't necessarily have to be the best, but you have to do your best for God. If a church is smaller, but yet the people are growing spiritually, they're being discipled, they're going out, they're trying to live out the Great Commission, guess what? That church is doing what they're supposed to be doing, and while they're small, they're doing their best for God, and God will see that, honor that, and bless that. And so other people might be able to do things more than you. Other people might have more money than you. Other people might have fancier things than you. But guess what? No matter what you do, do it for God, and God will see it, and He will bless it. Those people that came later worked just as hard as the ones who were there earlier. God saw it, and He blessed it. Stop comparing. Stop complaining and begrudging others' success. Stop striving for worldly accolades, but instead, stop jealousy and envy in its tracks by submitting to the sovereignty of God. By being secure in who God made you to be and knowing that it's all for His glory, and by doing your best for Him. Because guess what? Whether we want to admit it or not, each and every one of us in some way, shape, or form struggles with envy and jealousy. So the question is, do we need to become more secure? Do we need to submit and trust God more? Do we need to do our best for God and focus on Him instead of focusing on ourselves?